Today we're talking to James E. Lewis, Jr. about his new book, The Burr Conspiracy, Uncovering the Story of Early American Crisis. But first, before we start talking about the book, let's get a little background on you, the author.
Well, I teach at Kalamazoo College. I'm a professor in the history department there. I've been at Kalamazoo for 15, 16 years now. Before that, I had taught at a variety of places, University of Pennsylvania, University of Virginia, where I got my PhD, Louisiana State University. So I've been around a bit. I've published three books before this one, all of them generally in the field of U.S. diplomatic history. So this is a bit of a departure for me. I received my PhD in 1994 from the University of Virginia and had been at American University before that and William & Mary for my bachelor's degree.
You say a departure, but I understand you've put in something like 20 years into the research and writing of this book. Is that right?
That's basically correct. The ideas that produced it date back to 20 years ago. When I was wrapping up my first book, what had been my dissertation and then became my first book, and thinking about the next big project, this was what I landed on. And I've done a few smaller projects early in the process as well. But really, for 14 or 15 years, this has been it. This has been the focal point.
So how did you land on this? What caught your attention about this?
My first book was on the American response to the collapse of the Spanish Empire between the 1780s and the 1820s. And I was very interested in this as a problem of state systems and of union, and thinking about how people at the time thought about the United States as a very fragile union, something we don't tend to do anymore.
No.
We think of it as fragile in other ways, but not in terms of the states coming apart and going to war with each other and North America looking like Europe. And the prospect of independent nations emerging in Spanish America created that danger for them of other neighboring nations. And the Burr conspiracy raised in some ways the same danger, that here was a lot of the talk was that here was somebody who was setting out to create an independent empire in the Mississippi Valley that would possibly be from the Mississippi West, possibly be all the way up to the Appalachian Mountains, so including what we think of as the states of Kentucky and Ohio and Tennessee. And what would that mean to have a potentially very powerful nation on the borders of the United States and really including parts of the United States? So there was a very direct link. It was sort of the obviously international version is what I had done. And then what seemed to be a domestic version was kind of what appealed to me in the Burr conspiracy. Though what I had seen was that all of these things mixed together, foreign and domestic, because they were so uncertain that they were going to stay a single thing. What is domestic policy when you may break apart into?
I had that sense reading this that was actually the expectation, that at that point the United States would not be the United States we know today, but could very well form into, you mentioned Europe, maybe several countries.
And this is the fear, and this is the fear that drives the Constitution. And if you read the Federalists and they're explaining why we need a Constitution, it's to prevent that from happening. And so they're constantly worried that that things are going to come apart, that the bonds between the different parts of the country really aren't that strong, that they probably should be at least three or four separate nations, if not one per state, and that they will do what nations have always done when they're next to each other. They will go to war.
You've given us a small idea here of what the Burr conspiracy is. Why don't we step yet one step back? Tell us who Aaron Burr was.
Aaron Burr was a very fascinating figure. He had a very prominent family who was connected to people who had been the president of Princeton University, for example. So he is well connected. If you think of sort of the person, the classic person to counterpose him against is Alexander Hamilton, who, of course, he killed in a duel in the summer of 1804. And Hamilton's parentage was very uncertain. His parents weren't married. He'd come from the Caribbean. Burr is the exact opposite. He comes from a good family line. Now, his parents die when he's very young. He's left with uncles, but they are still well-connected New England family. He's prominent in the Revolution. He leads something that we don't think we ever did, but we did. We invaded Canada in 1775, and he's a part of that expedition against Canada. And he rises to colonel in the Revolution. And then he's a lawyer in New York. He becomes very active in New York state politics in the 1790s and really helps to turn New York City in particular, but New York State to some extent, toward the party of Jefferson, the Republican Party or Democratic Republican Party. And that activity gets him, in a sense, that didn't work exactly the same way, in a sense, on the ticket in the election of 1800, and he's Jefferson's running mate. He and Jefferson run for presidency and vice presidency. Because the Constitution set up a different system than the one we know now, they actually ended up being tied with each other in the Electoral College. And the system was that the person with the most electoral votes is president, and the second most electoral votes becomes vice president. But they were tied. Everybody knew.
I was going to ask you about that because I found that fascinating,
yeah.
The Electoral College, and quite different than how we elect presidents and vice presidents today. So if you can elaborate on that a little bit more.
Well, the election of 1800 is the reason we have the system we have now. Because the result of the election of 1800 was to plunge the nation into a crisis. Who would become president? And in a sense, everybody knew who was supposed to be president. Jefferson knew he was supposed to be president. The public knew that Jefferson was supposed to be president. The electors knew that Jefferson was supposed to be president. But the system really hadn't produced that result. And the opposition party, the Federalists, the party of Hamilton, were not at all certain they wanted Jefferson to be president. They were afraid Jefferson would destroy the country, would destroy the Union, would wreck all of the things that George Washington and Hamilton had done over the preceding 12 years, and very seriously considered the idea of electing Burr as the president. And so there was, going into Burr's vice presidency, there was already some very bad blood between him and his party and the person he was supposed to be partnered with as president and vice president. And then they never really recovered. And it was very clear by 1804, when the next presidential election came around, that there was going to be no room for Burr on the presidential ticket, that he was not going to be the vice president this time out. And so he moved out of national politics. Even as he is still vice president, he decides he's going to run for governor of New York. He decides that he's willing to court the Federalists in New York, the party of Hamilton, in order to win the election. And this is where all of the background for the duel with Hamilton comes up. Hamilton works against that election, and Burr does not win, kills Hamilton in the summer of 1804, goes back to Washington to be vice president, to finish out his term as vice president, and that's wrapped up by March of 1805. And that's really where the sort of kickoff for what would become the Burr conspiracy, or be talked about as the Burr conspiracy, is the sense that here's a man with tremendous ambition who has been in the second highest office in the land and is now tremendously frustrated, and what is he going to do next? And he starts looking at his options, but people start worrying about these ambitions. Then how are we going to contain them? How are we going to check them? And what might he be imagining that he could do to satisfy them?
So I found that very curious, that the way it was back then, vice president and president, because today certainly we think of it as a team of two people who can work together and support each other. Was the idea back then more of a checks and balances thing, or when did it change and how did it change?
There are really two things going on. One is that when the Constitution was written, there was no expectation that there would be parties. They didn't want there to be parties. So that's where the linking of men comes from, is through the political party system. So they didn't want that. What they thought was that the language they used was a filtration of talent. They wanted the people who would be at the very top, the president and the vice president, to be the kind of men, of course, who could win support from a large part of the country, and that they would be filtered out, that they would be filtered out first through the election, then through the Electoral College. And they actually thought that many elections would end up in the House of Representatives. The House of Representatives would choose between the top vote-getters in the Electoral College, and that was fine. That would then create another level of filtering, where the Congress, the House, voting by states, would choose the number one and the number two out of that. The number two, the vice president, was not seen as a very important office and was not really seen as a part of the president's cabinet for a long time. The vice president's most important position is to be the presiding officer of the Senate. And so in many ways, the vice president was seen as a member of the legislature, right? Linked more to the legislature than to the cabinet, certainly, or to the presidency.
And what was that relationship then between Jefferson and Burr? You've touched on it lightly, but tell us more about how they viewed each other.
Both of them are somewhat secretive, so we don't entirely know. Just based on the way things had developed in the preceding 12 years, there wouldn't have been an expectation that they would be great buddies, that Burr would be consulted on a lot of political decisions because he wasn't a part of the candidate of the cabinet as vice president. So I don't think we want to – wouldn't want to use our modern expectations and read back and say, boy, we see Biden sitting next to Obama or Pence sitting next to Trump in cabinet meetings. Burr doesn't seem to have been at any of these cabinet meetings. That must tell us something. It doesn't tell us anything. That wasn't the expectation. I do think things were tense between them, but I don't think that required a lot of daily interaction, just the nature of the relationship. And people weren't in the Capitol most of the year. The president would only have been in D.C. for five, 6 months out of the year, most years. Burr, the same. He was in New York. Jefferson was at Monticello, in Charlottesville, or in Virginia. They wouldn't have been forced to interact with each other a lot. But I do think it's very clear that when Jefferson and his top people were thinking about, all right, we're going to stand for re-election in 1804, there was no sense that Burr would be a part of that process.
Although it does seem that Jefferson said there wasn't much tension before, it seems like that changed later. So maybe we can talk more about how this conspiracy took shape. But we don't really know, do we, that it was real. Right. So maybe you can talk about that.
So the book is called The Burr Conspiracy. And there have been many other books called The Burr Conspiracy or some variation of that over the years. But The Burr Conspiracy should not be understood as I'm not saying that I know that there was a conspiracy that Burr was at the head of to do something illegal. I called the book The Burr Conspiracy, and I used the term The Burr Conspiracy throughout the book because that's what everybody has always called it. Or at the time, and maybe this should have been the title of the book, people called it Burr's Conspiracy. There was a tendency to personalize things.
Uh-huh.
So that was the language of the day. It's not a language I'm assigning to it. But nobody really knows. Nobody knows whether there was a conspiracy. It is clear that Burr was in contact with various men, that he was telling them stories about what he intended to do, that he was expressing these grand plans, that he had people that I think we can safely describe as his agents who were acting for him, meeting with people in other places, getting men together, buying provisions, making contracts for provisions. He was traveling around and having boats built to use on the Ohio and Mississippi rivers. He was contracting for provisions. He was sending some letters. We don't know how many because we don't know how many have been lost or destroyed, that people didn't want something that might implicate them that they weren't comfortable with. So there is something, we're pretty sure, but we don't know what the content of it was. We don't know what the direction of it was. But we know that Burr was a part of it, and we know that there were other men that he was talking with and working with, many of whom, as things started to blow up, as it became clear that the public was worried and the president was worried, many of whom wrote letters to the president, wrote letters to other members of the administration, wrote letters to newspapers, and said, yes, I had talked with him, and here's what he said, and wanted to distance themselves from this thing.
So how did this come to Jefferson's attention? And there's a little bit in there about manipulation of the facts, a little play with those letters.
Yeah. Jefferson is very clear in a very important message that he sends to Congress in January of 1807 of the timing of when he learned about this. He says that in the September and October of 1806, I started to receive letters and other members of the cabinet started to receive letters warning about this. And the reality is he had received letters warning him about Burr and the conspiracy, but they really dated back to February of 1806, 6 or 8 months earlier. And he had wanted to conceal that from the public. Because if he said, I've known about this for a year and I started acting on it 2 months ago, that's hard to explain. And he knew it'd be hard to explain. If he said, I've been acting on this really since October when we started having cabinet meetings, we had just found out about this. That makes a lot more sense, right? So that's the story he tells. And it's amazingly the story he sticks to long after his presidency, all the way up till 4 or 5 years before he dies. He's still telling that story, even though in the interim, very shortly after the message, the man who had sent him the earliest warning said, I was sending you letters all through the spring of 1806. I was on the ground in Kentucky. He was at the district attorney in Kentucky. This is just a lie. And he prints these letters for everybody to read.
Today, we're so used to media, the social media and all that. Everything is so quick. We know practically in the moment that something happens. It's a very different world in that time. And how communication with Washington, D.C. happened? What were some of the challenges?
For me, this was a crucial part of telling this story, is to understand how people made sense of what was happening. And that means understanding how information is getting to them. And historians have been interested in this for a long time. They've written about the technology of it. This is a period before telegraphs. It's a period before anything really faster than a person or a horse or a ship, right? That's the speed at which information is going to have to move. Historians have been interested in the institutional side of it, how the government very early on made a commitment to spreading the news and to going to a lot of expense in order to make that possible. It was relatively cheap to send letters. It was much cheaper to send newspapers. And the government agreed to send newspapers between different editors for free, so that they could know, you could know in Philadelphia what was happening in Lexington, Kentucky, and could do that on the cheap. So then the information in this period is really moving, of course, through conversation and travel. It's moving through letters. It's moving, but especially through newspapers. And the newspapers of 1805, 6, 7 were very heavily partisan. There were Federalist newspapers and there were Republican newspapers. And really, just about any community of size would have both. And they would articulate these very different messages. And the Republican newspapers had a network. They, through the exchange of these free copies, they knew what other Republican editors were saying. And there were a handful in Philadelphia, in Washington, D.C., in Richmond, who were particularly important in kind of shaping the Republican interpretation. And in the same way, the Federalists had a newspaper network, and they had their main newspapers in Philadelphia and New York and Boston that shaped their interpretation and got it out to these more local newspapers. So things are traveling through the mails, which can be slow. It could take weeks to get mail from the West to Washington, D.C., and vice versa. It could take weeks to get mail from New Orleans to Kentucky because it's upriver and it's not easy to do. But in other ways, the information is moving very well. They are getting lots of information, and they were as frequently complaining about too much information as too little information, and which sounds kind of familiar, right? That that there was just too much out there. They couldn't tell what was good information and what wasn't. They weren't always getting it from where they wanted it as quickly as they wanted it, but they were learning lots of stuff, hearing lots of stuff. And through the height of the crisis in 1806 and early 1807, they frequently felt like there was too much for them to sort out, and that what they read in the paper today was contradicted in the paper of the next day. And they couldn't decide what to think, which is partly why this message of Jefferson's to Congress was so important, because in a sense it told Republicans what to think. It answered the question, okay, here's what Burr was up to, here's what the administration has done, and from that moment on, once they saw that, and it took a couple of weeks, depending on where you were, Republicans knew what they were supposed to think about this event.
But Jefferson felt that there was treason there, and he brought him to trial. Tell us about how that took shape and how it was, well, resolved, if that's the right word.
Yes, Jefferson, in his message to Congress, said that Burr's treason was obvious, that this was a case of treason. Now, of course, the president should not be saying that. That's getting into all sorts of problems. And he was called on that at the time by the Federalists. About a month after Jefferson's message to Congress, but at the other end of the country, down in Alabama, what's now Alabama, Burr was arrested. He was taken to Virginia, and he was put on trial in Richmond for events that happened at a place called Blennerhassett Island. Blennerhassett Island is in the Ohio River. It's downstream from Parkersburg, West Virginia, Marietta, Ohio. But at the time, there was no West Virginia. West Virginia was Virginia. And so Blennerhassett Island was in Virginia, and Richmond was the proper place to try a federal crime, a treason offense, potential treason offense on Blennerhassett Island. The effects, though, of being in Richmond were twofold. One was that this is a period when Supreme Court justices rode circuit, and they would go out to the district courts and circuit courts and hear cases. And so this was a circuit court case in Richmond, and it ended up being the circuit of John Marshall, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, one of the leading Federalist voices after the death of Hamilton, and a real opponent of Jefferson on many issues. Because it was in Richmond, it was also close to Jefferson, whether he was in Washington or in Monticello. And there wasn't the whole apparatus. There was no Justice Department. There was an attorney general. The attorney general didn't recuse himself in a formal sense, but just didn't get involved in the case because he had a sick son and he wanted to stay home in Delaware with his sick son. So Jefferson ended up having fairly regular correspondence with the district attorney in Richmond, the lead prosecutor in the Burr case. So you get this incredible trial, and people at the time recognize it. They didn't have the phrase trial of the century, but if they had, they would have used it. They recognize that you have this incredible circumstance. You have one of the most prominent men in the country, the former vice president, on trial for the most important crime imaginable, treason. It has the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court as the presiding judge. Jefferson is kind of floating around off in the wings there. It draws to Richmond a vast crowd. Newspapers are covering it all across the country. People are coming in to make transcripts of the trial with the expectation that they can be sold and money can be made on them. Witnesses are coming in from all over the place. Very prominent men are coming in to testify. Very prominent. Some of the most important lawyers of the day are coming in on the two sides. So it's this incredible event that, in a sense, dissipates into nothing because Burr is indicted for treason along with six others. He is put on trial for treason beginning in early August of 1807. But by the end of August, his lawyers have figured out a way to sort of defeat the prosecution case, and they make a motion to Justice Marshall and say, you know, Burr wasn't at Blennerhassett Island. How can we be tried for treason at Blennerhassett Island? Burr was hundreds of miles away. And Marshall decides they're right, that he can't be charged with treason with the act of levying war on Blennerhassett Island against the United States when he wasn't even there. And the trial fritters away into nothing. They then try him on a misdemeanor offense, the misdemeanor of organizing an expedition against a nation at peace with the United States, Spain, Spanish Mexico, or Spanish Florida. That also dies on the same issue, that he wasn't on Blennerhassett Island. And very quickly, the trial kind of winds down. There's a lot of furor at Marshall, including on the part of the president, who tries to figure out what can be done to rein in the Supreme Court and the judicial branch, which is still under the control of the Federalists. There's a lot of popular hostility against Marshall. Marshall's burned in effigy in Baltimore, along with Burr and a couple of others. But in terms of Burr himself, this is it. He does stand trial, but he's never found guilty. He's never really suffers any legal consequence for the conspiracy, though he suffers a huge sort of public relations consequence. He's, from that point on, really throughout the 19th century, thought of as one of the great traitors of American history, second only to Benedict Arnold.
But even though it really settles down then to a conspiracy theory, you've spent 20 years researching this. Do I get to press you against the wall here and ask, what do you think? Guilty or not guilty?
You can press, but I won't answer it. Now, I set out on the project thinking I was going to answer the question that nobody had ever answered, and that I would just be willing to do whatever research it took to be able to really answer the question. And I figured out pretty quickly that it wasn't about a lack of diligence on the people who had tried to write about this before, that the evidence just isn't there. And I decided that I was interested in other issues and that answering other questions would actually tell me more about early America than knowing what Burr really intended to do. And so I got very interested in how people made sense, how people decided that this was a crisis. What were they afraid of? Mm-hmm. What were they seeing in these fragmentary reports, these rumors, these contradictory stories that made them think that there was a real danger? Why were they scared? And then what was it that got them from tremendous uncertainty to tremendous confidence that they knew? And we don't know. I mean, we have better evidence than any one person at the time had. I was able to see, I'm sure, more than any one person saw in 1807. I don't know. And yet they knew. They had decided by the spring and early summer of 1807 that they knew. They knew that he was guilty, that he was a traitor, or conversely, they knew that he wasn't guilty, that he was merely the victim of Jefferson's political fury. How did they arrive at that point? Those questions to me seem to offer much more about what it was like in the politics of early America. What was that culture like? How did people think? How did people understand the relationship between their localities and big political issues? How did they take this conflicting web of news and arrive at something that they could act on? And they had to act. For us, it's purely academic, right? Whether Burr was intending treason or intending to invade Mexico or intending merely, as the other story was, to set up a colony of kind of like-minded men and women out in the Louisiana Purchase, it's all academic to us. It wasn't to them. It was their country on the line. It was their Republican government on the line. So they had to arrive at enough of an answer to act or to support or oppose the actions of others who really could do something in this moment of crisis. And that's what seemed to me to be a much more important story than knowing whether Burr was really thinking the things that he was accused of thinking.
Looking back on that today, you've got to feel there's some echoes. And what did we learn from that day that is still an issue today, or is once again an issue today? Partisanship, collaborations with foreign governments, whether the president and the top people in the country are above the law or not, executive privilege, all of that. Can we learn anything from this history that we can apply today?
I think we certainly can, but I also think, as historians always think, that we have to be careful. We have to not just leap to the conclusion that it's either, A, always been like this, or that there are things in the Burr conspiracy that are exactly analogous to things today. There are some important similarities. The sense that the media is politicized, I think, is much higher now than the reality of media politicization. There was no belief at all in an objective press. That just wasn't something that you were even aspiring to. And I think now there's, at least aspirationally, there's much greater commitment to understanding what's going on, getting the facts, and getting the facts out to the public. You don't always see it in certain television venues because they devote a lot more of their time to opinion and, you know, analysis. But if you look at the work of mainstream newspapers, whether you see them as having a little bit of a liberal bent or a little bit of a conservative bent, they're still, for the most part, committed to the facts. That was not usually there in the early decades of the 19th century. That just wasn't a part of it. There was the way they did that was to spend a lot of time compiling stuff from other newspapers and bringing stuff together from foreign newspapers and domestic newspapers. But even then, there was if you read a Republican newspaper from Lexington, Kentucky, you're very unlikely to find something from a Federalist newspaper in it. They're not clipping the Federalist newspapers from the East Coast. They're clipping the other Republican newspapers from the East Coast. So the politicized media is similar, but I think it's not identical. And the ways in which it's not identical in some ways favor us, right? We do have more of a commitment to getting the facts out probably than they did.
Circling back for just a moment to the Electoral College, there's a debate that's been going on for a while now. Is it obsolete? The way it was used then and how we elect presidents and vice presidents today, do we still need it?
I don't know that I want to come down one way or another on that. I think that the purposes that it was designed to serve are not really purposes that we would want to defend it on now. There are other purposes that it might serve, and that is to give representation to states that don't have the population to sort of merit equal representation. That's just the reality of the Electoral College. It was based on the idea that the states were an important actor as well, and not just the people, the mass, the people. When the Constitution was written, there was very little support for the idea of democracy, certainly very little support on the part of the people who were writing the Constitution. And democracy was a very tainted word. The history of democracy was not great. And so they were trying to figure out ways to balance different desires, to give the people a voice, to have this be a government of the people, and at the same time to recognize that the states had rights, that they were important political entities of their own. The states, up to the early 20th century, the states chose their senators and the U.S. government in the state legislature. It wasn't something that you and I would have elected, or even me, a guy, would have elected and not you. It was just something that the state legislatures chose. They were the representative of the state in the national capital. And the Electoral College, in a sense, got a lot of that still built into it. The idea that we're not just a single nation, we are also a federation of states, and that we want to have some system, some structure that recognizes that. If we decide we're not that, then we really got a lot more to do than just fix the Electoral College, because so much of our day-to-day life is run by the fact that we live in a state, Michigan, that has its own government, and a county that has its own government, and a city that has its own government. If we're really thinking about there should be nothing but, you know, the 50% plus one of the country as a whole making the decision of who the president is, then I think that is it some way at odds with our whole structure of government that has these different levels.
As a historian, when you wrote this book, was your approach simply, I want to get down a piece of history? Or did you want to convey a certain message to the reader that you hope that they'll get from this?
I certainly had an argument and questions. I wanted to be clear that I had an interpretive perspective on this. I don't think any academic historian would say that he or she simply wanted to tell the story. We always have questions that have brought us to this past and arguments, interpretations that we want to get across to our reader. That said, I also, from the beginning, knew that I wanted to write it for an audience that wasn't simply an academic audience, that it wasn't simply writing for other professional historians. I had done that before. I'd written a little book for Monticello to sell at its gift shop on the Louisiana Purchase. And when I was doing that, I thought very seriously about what does that mean? What do I not do if I want to write for a popular audience? What can I do if I want to write for a popular audience? And so this book was written very much with that in mind. It was written to be accessible. It was written, there's really no jargon. There's a real effort to make sure that people who aren't well-versed in this can follow what's going on. At the same time, I wanted to write something that I would have wanted to read. And I want to read things that are engagingly written, that are creatively structured, that don't just plod day by day through a chronology, but actually do interesting things with their organization, interesting things both at the grand level of the chapters, but also within the chapters, how things unfold. For me as the writer, there's this whole swirling world of things that I can talk about at any moment. For you as the reader, it's going to be one sentence after the next. And so I have to get that swirling universe into the form that I think will be the best experience for you who are going to experience this as a very linear thing in a way that I've never had to experience it as a very linear thing until I wrote it. I didn't write it in order. I wrote, I think, chapter 9 first, and I bounced all over the place, just depending on what I felt ready to write, depending on places that had asked me to give talks and the like, and what I was wanted to give a talk about. So it wasn't until very late in the game that I sat down with a complete draft and read it from start to finish in the way that a reader will read it. And then, of course, did a lot of tweaking to get the reader's experience to match up to what I wanted it to be. So I really wanted it to be something that anybody who cares about American history can come to and read and learn from and learn about this time period and learn about the hopes and fears of people 200 years ago and how those hopes and fears shaped their ability to make sense of an important event going on around them. Now, that is something that we can say, of course, that has a modern analog. We're always in that position. Humans are always trying to make sense of the world around them. Now, the things that we're worried about are different. The things that that provide us with information are different. Our hopes are probably different in many ways. But the reality of trying to make sense of confusing events and trying to do so in ways that are framed by our hopes and our fears, what we think we know, the stories we have told ourselves, the stories we have been told over the years, all of those things, I think, are continuous from 200 years ago and before.